Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, the main Turton, John Lash, recording on the 6th of July, 2013. This would be the fourth installment in the Nav Briefing 73 with the generic title, Where the Nightmare Ends. And the subtitle for this talk is Sophia's Magnificat. Now, I'd like to say that I am grateful for the responses that come to me from you out there. I don't know too many of you in the flesh. I haven't had the occasion to meet you. But I have met a few of you who've come to see me in Europe. And I know that there is an attendance to my work. There is an attendance of considerable depth and strength. And lately I feel coming from that attendance a lot of love and support, protection, encouragement, a lot of recognition. I do receive, almost on a daily basis, messages of love and encouragement that I find to be really nourishing and a great pleasure to receive. So I just wanted you to know that I think about getting out there, I think about reaching you, I think about how you receive me. As you know, that is a Turton's concern. First, there is discovery, and then there is delivery. And I do put a lot of attention to my delivery, as you know. But equally so, I know that you are reaching me. And I can assure you that you are reaching me, and this is a moment when our solidarity in the sacred narrative becomes palpable. For me, this is the case. The solidarity of the Anthropos becomes palpable. It's what the Russians called Sobernost. Don't know how to pronounce it in Russian, S-O-B-E-R-N-O-S-T, Sobernost. Sobernost was a word that Soloviev liked to use. You might recall that Vladimir Soloviev, who died in August of 1900, close to the same time as Friedrich Nietzsche, was the godfather of Russian Sophianic mysticism. And he was the mentor and central figure of inspiration that loomed over the Russian symbolist movement. In itself, the Russian symbolist movement, led by Andrei Bielli and Alexander Bloch, was a reflection of the reemergence of the Sophianic impulse into the world at large. Through Vladimir Soloviev and the Russian symbolists, and those who were not necessarily in the symbolist movement, such as Velimir Klevnikov, my favorite Russian poet, but who were deeply inspired by the return to the indigenous shamanic roots of Russia, and who, in that return, re-identified the Sophianic presence. I refer to this group often, as you know, and I can say something about them now that I haven't been able to say before, and I think this is rather remarkable. So I'm happy to share with you this insight that's come to me during my travels. Remember that the talks under NB73 form part of a kind of travelogue, travels with the Turton, if you will. And so I've been speaking about the things that I experienced here in Belgium when I first came here, including my adventures, some of my adventures, among la noblesse belge, the Belgian nobility. Now, the story of Lohengrin is, as it were, the legitimating myth of Belgian nobility, as if they could care about that. But were those people in that genre to look at themselves honestly and to view their lives in a mythical perspective, they would understand the importance of the figure of Lohengrin. Now, you can read about the Lohengrin story, as I said, in the second chapter of the Alternative History of the Grail, where Lohengrin is called the Swan Knight. And I'm going to link with this talk, post with this talk, a link to a page where you can see an image of the Swan Knight as painted by the Austrian Illuminist painter Ernst Fuchs, F-U-C-H-S. Now, I am not by any means a great fan of Ernst Fuchs, who is a religious fanatic and probably a theocrat. And he has 16 children. But, you know, sometimes art, one of the beautiful things about art, whether it be literature, painting, sculpture, it allows a human animal to transcend themselves. For instance, I'm not a great fan of Picasso, but I really do claim that Picasso transcended himself when he did the lithograph of Dance with Banderillas. And there are a couple of other works of art like that in which Picasso transcended himself. And that is to say, something of the pure demonic came through him as an artist. Well, likewise, I think that's true with the portrait of Lohengrin by Ernst Fuchs. So you can look at that. And it's interesting that when you go on Google Images and look for it, what comes up is metahistory.org. So that's a fortuitous association. Anyway, the insight that I've just had over the last few days concerns a statement I made about the failure of the Lohengrin impulse. Well, you would understand why I consider that the Lohengrin impulse failed. I mean, that's obvious. Insofar as the European nobility, whether it be in France, Belgium, Germany, and so forth, have not fulfilled any kind of altruism, they have absolutely and utterly failed the mission of Lohengrin. And insofar as they have relied on their name to traffic in the world, very often not paying their bills, I can assure you of that, just because of their names. To the extent that they've relied on their name and family prestige and the lineage, genealogical lineage, which contains a huge factor of fabrication, they have not come anywhere close to the Lohengrin ideal. So what I proposed in covering that story was the significance of Bruges as a port of departure into the North Sea, heading to the extreme antipodes of Rome, which would have been Finland. Now, the port of Anvers or Antwerp is not far from where Bruges would have been in the 12th century, because Bruges was at the sea at that time, as I explained. So a departure from Anvers and a departure from Bruges would essentially be the same departure. So let's say that Lohengrin, the mythical figure who represents the mission of the European nobility to preserve culturally and intellectually some remnants of the Grail mystery, Lohengrin departed into the North Sea, and let's say that he took the route of the diaspora of the diaspora, I'll pronounce it in that way on this occasion, he took the northern route, which led to Finland, and certainly into Russia. Why do I say certainly? Well, this is where it gets really interesting in terms of historical detail. I was unable to go any further in the alternative history of the Grail than the 12th century. Around 1250, I lose track of the thread. It appears that the diaspora went totally underground after the period when Wolfram von Eschenbach and his colleague Gottfried of Strasbourg, who wrote Tristan, were composing their masterpieces. So in order to complete the remaining three chapters of the Alternative History of the Grail, which I would very much like to do because I think it would make a terrific book, it needs some editing and cleaning up, but it has some of my best historical detective work in it, I must say. In order to complete that, I would have to account for two things. First, what happened during the 600 years that the Grail Stream was totally underground, from 1250 to 1850. What happened in the world, and the significance of those events relative to the complete occlusion of the Grail mystery. The second thing I would have to show is historical evidence of the reemergence of the Grail impulse in Russia at the end of the 19th century. And I can most certainly do that. You might have caught this detail already. I pointed out that there was a royal family called the Trubetskoy. And in fact, the Trubetskoys were close friends of Vladimir Soloviev. And Prince Trubetskoy, of which there are a number because it was a successive line of princes, Prince Trubetskoy was a close friend of Soloviev. Now, you have to go to the period of Peter the Great and the founding of St. Petersburg in the Gulf of Finland. Okay? When St. Petersburg was founded, it was established as the first true European city in Russia. It was not meant to be a Russian city. It was meant exclusively a Russian city, like Moscow or Kiev. It was meant to be a Russian city facing the West. And so you have the notion of the Europhile or Francophile Russians as opposed to the Russophile Russians. And this is a big issue of the time. But essentially, St. Petersburg was founded as an outpost of Europe on the coast of Russia in the Gulf of Finland. And there was, from the time of Peter the Great, well up into the middle of the 20th century, when I believe the last remnant of the Trubetskoy family committed suicide in Paris. There was, up until that moment, an ongoing event of cross-fertilization from Russia and Europe. And the point of cross-fertilization in Europe was primarily, though not exclusively, Paris. So you had these Parisian intellectuals, you had an enormous number of French-speaking Russians. In fact, the Russians spoke French more than they spoke their own language. Some of them did. And so the Trubetskoy family, as far as I can tell, may have carried the last thread of the diaspora to Russia through this juncture between the Paris-St. Petersburg connection. And it may well be that Trubetskoy privately confided with Vladimir Soloviev and people in his circle regarding a knowledge of the mysteries. And in that respect, the Trubetskoy family, as a representative of nobility, would have carried through the mission of Lohengrin. Can you see that? But it would have been Russian nobility who completed the mission of Lohengrin, strangely enough. And so the mission of Lohengrin was not an entire failure, but it did, once that impulse, once that thread of transgenerational continuity emerged in Russia, in the Russian symbolist genre and the Sofianic mysticism of Soloviev, well, it was like a sprout of a rare plant that burst forth out of the earth in the middle of a catastrophic battleground conflict. Because at the very moment that the transgenerational continuity of the Grail impulse emerged in Russia, the entire country was in the throes of the Russian Revolution. And that was an immense problem, which really can teach you so much today if you want to go back and study it a little. That was an immense problem. But I'll boil the problem down to one thing. Sobonost, solidarity. Soloviev was a brilliant intellectual. He was a poet and a genuine mystic. He records two encounters that he had with the divine Sophia. One of them in Egypt, one of them in the British Library in London. Take your pick. When Soloviev talked about Sobonost and another Russian notion, unfortunately, of godmanship, that is to say, there was a theocratic element infecting Soloviev's vision. He was, of course, a Greek Orthodox Russian. So he was a Christian. But he could have overcome that. You know, the art of Russian symbolism, the Russian symbolist, it's not symbolism. The art and literature of the Russian symbolist movement was so rich and powerful that it could have provided Soloviev and others a vehicle to transcend their Christianity and to transcend their cultural conditioning and really bring forth a viable vision, a viable version of the Sofianic message. The reasons why that did not happen are many. One reason, of course, is that there was tremendous opposition to it. And I would argue that to a certain extent, apart from the international banking cartels that funded the Russian Revolution, and apart from other factors behind the evil of Jewish Bolshevism, I would argue that the genocide deriving from the Russian Revolution was due to a murderous reaction against the reemergence of the Sofianic impulse, the Grail mystery, and access to the organic light. The way that psychopaths, and particularly the Zadokite control freaks, react to any possibility that the Gnostic and Sofianic message will emerge is by a murderous rampage of insanity. That is the greatest threat to their program, the greatest threat to their existence, period. So that was, all these are factors, but primarily the Lohengrin impulse brought into Russia by the Trubetskoy lineage failed because the godfather of the movement, Soloviev, could not provide an iconic figure for the Anthropos. As you know, Christ, or Jesus slash Christ, no matter how you whack it, and how you hack it cannot represent the Anthropos. The icon of Christ / Jesus is far too corrupted to represent the Anthropos. We face today the same problem that Solovia faced and the same problems that the Teleste of the Mystery School faced at the end of their institutions. That is the problem of how to integrate a generic species identity for humanity into the Sophianic message. That's what the Anthropos is. The Anthropos is not humanity out there teeming in the streets. No, that's not the Anthropos. The Anthropos is the subject of this experiment, understood to be expressed through the human species. The human species as the subject of a divine experiment is the Anthropos. The human species as you see it, as the animal herd driven by conditioning and by the deceits of history, is not the same critter. So this is a great challenge, and I haven't solved this challenge. I am sharing it with you. You've inherited it with me through the term of Gaia Awakening. So the solidarity, that Sobornost concept of the Russians, which comes to definition in Soloviev, did not find the actual viable definition that it needed. So there was no, get this, there was no genuine and viable ideal of humanity that could have driven the Russian Revolution to a positive result. You know, communism is an evil derived from the Zadokite agenda. Communism is a ploy of the global banking mafia, of central banking criminals, that appears to champion equality of the common people and the ownership of means and resources by the workers. But that is an enormous lie. Communism is an enormous lie, which is used by the global cabal to loot nations. But if there were to be any form of communism that was humane, it would have to be founded upon a generic, iconic image of humanity. Without that, how could you have a humane or humanitarian form of communism? That is to say, of society organized for the general good, rather than a society manipulated for the good of a very small number of deceitful and murderous human animals. I mean, how could you possibly even have such a thing? Now, you find another attempt later on at the midpoint of the 20th century to define Sobornost, that is to say, to give an image to the solidarity of the Anthropos. And where do you find that? Well, go read The Murder of Christ by Wilhelm Reich. You know, Reich drew once again upon the traditional icon or archetype of Christ, as to say Christ represents the truly alive, orgasmic, rational human being. And that's why he had to be murdered, because the psychopaths who succumbed to military and militaristic and mystical armoring will always destroy life. They are afraid of life. Remember I said the lesson of the satanic mask of Cetus is that we face the threat of biophobia, people who are afraid of life. And when that threat is combined with masking or pretending, it becomes the greatest threat. Communism is an example. Russian communism was driven by a small faction of about 200 Bolshevik Jews, and they represent the Zadokite program and the position of the Zadokite program is to stand against humanity, against the Anthropos, against life, and against all that lives, and to fight for another kingdom, to lay waste to the world so that it can be restored as a different kingdom to a small group of God's favorite animals. Okay? So, this is the problem that Reich also confronted head on. And he had a sentimental and humanistic feeling for communism. He was never really a communist. He may have belonged to the Communist Party at some point, but he was never really a communist in the way the Jewish Bolsheviks were communists, nor even in the way that the National Socialists of Germany were communists. He was a communist in the sense that he was a social worker who was dedicated to the common good of the common people. That's communism. But you can't have that kind of communism as a political structure on this planet without focusing it in Sobernost, in the solidarity of the Anthropos, and in a common image of humanity, or what I call the species self-identity. So there you go. There's some background of my reflections regarding what happened with the Lohengrin impulse. It was not entirely a failure, but when the transmission was achieved through Soloviev, and I can go into quite a bit more detail about this, the emergence of the Sofianic impulse in Russia happened at the worst possible time. So, the problem of Sobernost, how to achieve solidarity among human animals, then overcome the deceitful strategies of division, which are used by the perpetrators. Remember, domination, deceit, and division is the 3D method of the perpetrators. So the only way to overcome this insane division and infighting that goes on, even among good people, even among those who are united against, say, the globalist mafia, are constantly infighting among themselves. How is this to be overcome? There's only one way to overcome it. There is a missing factor in the imagination of the human race, and that is the imagination of its own generic identity. And that issue was left unresolved by the Gnostics at the time of Hypatia, because they were wiped out, persecuted, murdered, and driven underground. And consequently, they did not have the opportunity to solve that problem. I've talked about this in Not in His Image regarding the hijacking of the figure of Hermas. So enough of that. It's kind of reviewing material. What I'd like to do for the main part of this briefing is to go into the moment ahead, which is actually tomorrow, July 7th. And I'd like to talk at length about the particular navigational parameters of that day, July 7th, 2013. Now, as I undertake this little exercise, I'm having my breakfast, and you might hear the ice cubes clicking. As you know, in keeping with my policy of complete transparency, I'd be happy to inform you of what I'm having for breakfast. There's a mug filled about 3/4 full with milk. I've added some ice cubes to the milk, and then I poured in a huge dose of Kahlua. And just smelling the vapors of that Kahlua. So delightful. So that's my breakfast. Kahlua and milk on ice. And here's my breakfast discourse on the moment of Sophia's Magnificat. You know, I've set up a pretty big expectation here, folks. And I don't like to set up expectations, so what am I doing? Well, as you know, the proper word, the more correct term in this GNE event of ours, in this little experiment, is anticipation. If you read the continuum concept by Jean Liedlow, the continuum concept, you will see where she absolutely nailed the importance of the experience of anticipation in the life of the human animal. I will not say that what you anticipate always comes about. That is a wrong expression. That is bad syntax. What you anticipate may come about depending on the way you hold that anticipation and the way you develop it. And the proper use of anticipation, which is absolutely essential to the functions of the human animal and actually arises out of the calibration of our sevenfold endowment, it's one of the capacities or faculties, capabilities, you could say, of the anthropos, anticipation, the manner in which you use it is crucial. And right now we stand at a moment of great opportunity regarding A, what to anticipate, and B, how to hold and carry forward that anticipation in time. Now I've made a rather strong claim about this moment, July 7th. And what did I say? Precisely that it is the moment, the first moment in the 3 years of initialization of correction when the Aeon Sophia perfectly coordinates her first and second attentions. You can quote me on that. In fact, I wish you would. Now, how do I know that? When I asked you to come and stand on the navigation deck with me, look over my shoulder as I lean over my charts with my compasses and my various rulers and the devices of navigation, the star charts, the lunar cycle calendar, the apogee and perigee mechanism of the barycenter of the Earth and so forth. I said, just by leaning over my shoulder, you'll learn how I use these navigational tools and then you can use them yourself. Well, here comes a really, really lovely lesson. The Gnostic moment happens when there is a coincidence between the apogee of the moon and the position of Jupiter in the apogee of the moon, coinciding with the perihelion of Saturn. That is all totally astronomical. The only thing that is not astronomical in that statement that I just made is the metaphorical title, if you will, the Gnostic moment. That is the title I give to a discrete and granular astronomical event happening right now. Now let me go into a little more detail on that event so you can be conceptually and graphically crystal clear about what I'm describing. I'm going to ask you to stand as if you were standing in the proscenium of a theater, and above you, but somewhat in front of you, so that you can look up at it, is the arch of the proscenium of the theater. Let's say that that's the zodiac. And as you look up at the apex of the arch, you see the Milky Way, the illustration of the Milky Way, flowing sort of at a slanted angle, but more or less flowing vertically across the proscenium arch, the Milky Way, like a little band of blue. On the right side of that band is the constellation of the Bull with the two horn stars extending into the blue patch of the Milky Way River. On the left side of that blue band, in that part of the proscenium arch, which then descends down to the stage floor, is the constellation of the twins. And they are so displayed that they seem to be laying back at an angle, say of an angle about 30 degrees off the horizontal, and bathing their toes, bathing their feet in the Milky Way. The two prominent stars of the constellation of the twins are to the left in the graphic visualization, and they are the head stars, Castor and Pollux. But there are a number of stars which mark the feet of the twins. They're dimmer, but they can be made out, and in general, the formation of the twins is more or less recognizable. You know that the stars of any constellation are called the composite. They are the stars that compose the constellation. And the visualization that you impose upon the composite is called the graphics of the constellation. So, of course, when you look up, you don't see twins. I'm teaching you to see twins, which is exactly what the astronomical teachers in the Mysteries did. They taught their students to form these visualizations and to superpose the visualization or graphics on the composite. So you're looking up at the proscenium arch, almost straight up, and that would be 90 degrees. The midpoint of the proscenium arch is 90 degrees on the ecliptic scale. So if you go down the arch all the way to the floor on the right, you go to 0 degrees. And then you come back up 90 degrees, and you're at the center point and the apex. If you proceed from that 90-degree mark down along the proscenium arch to the left, to the floor of the stage, you come to 180 degrees. That's the visualization of the zodiac standing and facing south and up in the northern hemisphere, standing and facing north and up in the southern hemisphere. Okay. Now, look up there and imagine that the mark of 90 degrees, which is exactly the center mark of the proscenium arch, is a vertical line, a red vertical line. As you edge away from that red vertical line, moving left, you have 91 degrees, 92, 93, so forth and so on. So there are about 26 degrees. That is to say, you get to the 116-degree mark and you come to the head stars of the twins. But we're not going there right now. That's for the end of the 3 years, the passage beyond the head stars of the twins. Right now, we're looking at the location of the lunar apogee. Now, you know you can't see the lunar apogee itself. The apogee means furthest away from the Earth, which is G or Gay or Gaia. So you can't actually see that point, but you notice when the moon passes that point because it appears smaller than at any other time. So let's say you're going to make a white mark just 2 degrees to the left of the 90-degree mark at the center of the proscenium arch. You make a little white mark there in the shape of a white dot. That is the lunar apogee. Then you bring the crescent moon around, the fine, small crescent that appears just before the end of the lunar cycle, and you place the lunar crescent on that white dot. Then, just below that, you place the planet Jupiter. You don't have to visualize it. You could actually see Jupiter in the sky. If you were to go out in the morning sky now, before sunrise, well, you would see Jupiter at the feet of the twins. So directly below the white spot, apogee of the moon, where the crescent moon is located on July 7th, you place the planet Jupiter. There's one more factor to add. It so happens that all the planetary orbits, are ellipses, just like the orbit of the moon, which is an ellipse. So it has a near point to the Earth, perigee, and a far point from the Earth, apogee. But the moon is a satellite of the Earth, whereas the Earth and the other planets rotate around the sun. But they also have the equivalent to an apogee and perigee point, but they are called aphelion and perihelion. Why would that be? Simply because the reference is to the sun, Helios, and not to the Earth, Gaia, or G. So apogee and perigee only apply to the moon. The equivalent terms apply to all the planets. So where are these aphelion and perihelion points on the proscenium arch? Well, these points are invisible without physical markings, but you can locate them against the starry background of the constellation. In fact, it's a pretty easy exercise given the longitudes on the ecliptic of their positions to just map out where they are in the constellations. At this moment, in 2013, I want you to focus all your attention on one perihelion point. That is the perihelion of Saturn. That means that in making a full circle of the zodiac every 28 years, there's a moment when Saturn stands closest to the sun. Moment. And that is the moment when it occupies that point at the feet of the twins, where the lunar apogee and Jupiter are now conjoined. So here is your complete visualization. Look up at the apex of the proscenium arch. Move your gaze just slightly to the left, 2 degrees. You want to be at 92 degrees. The white dot of the lunar apogee, the white sickle of the lunar moon, the golden star of Jupiter, and a green triangle representing the perihelion of Saturn, all completely aligned, perfectly aligned. So that is the granular detail of astronomical events at the moment of July 7th, 2013. Now, what does this tell me, the navigator, about the operations of the first and second attention of the wisdom goddess, the planetary animal mother? Well, remember the rule introduced at the beginning of this experiment. Tracking the lunar apogee through the constellations during these 3 years, you see the operations of divine memory, which is also the same as imagination, because memory and imagination are actually the same faculty. Your memory is simply a subset of your imagination. It's the replay button on your faculty of imagination. With your power of imagination, you can not only imagine, dream, picture, conceive, and invent stories and scenes and happenings, but you can also replay actual stories and scenes and happening. So memory is the replay function of the imaginative faculty. In the GNE, I associate the operations of the imaginative and mnemonic powers of the goddess with the lunar apogee. And in a correlating expression, I associate the divine alchemy or transmutational power of the first attention of the wisdom goddess with the lunar perigee, the near point of the moon. So we have divine alchemy, lunar perigee, first attention, divine memory and divine imagination, lunar apogee, second attention. Well, obviously, something momentous is happening with the second attention of the Aeon Sophia. It is not merely a moment of emphasis for the second attention, which occurs once a month when the moon transits its apogee, but it is the first moment of apogee in the twins, beginning the third phase of the 3 years, with the anticipation of a great lesson to be learned. And it is also a moment when the apogee of the moon happens to coincide remarkably with this other point among what astronomers call the planetary osculating elements, that is to say, the perihelion of Saturn. And as I explained in another briefing, I determined through my studies with Willy Sucker and through the astronomical forensic method of eonics, E-O-N-I-C-S, pioneered by Dane Rudjar, that I was able to determine that the perihelia and aphelia points of the planets, to use their plural forms, represent massive impulses like biorhythms that operate through the long centuries of historical time. And it was an amazing process of learning over many years to identify and define which transhistorical impulses were indicated by which points, as you can imagine. The apsides of Saturn, the perihelion and the aphelion points, which are opposite, represent something that works in human history and in the collective life of the Anthropos like a biorhythm. But it is a biorhythm informed with particular motifs and drives and capacities. So to return back to that Wagnerian term of leitmotif, or leitmotif, don't know how it's pronounced anymore, say leitmotif, perihelion of Saturn is a transhistorical leitmotif, indicating a massive impulse working itself out through the life of the Anthropos over many generations. And likewise, the aphelion of Saturn, located at the opposite point. Where is the aphelion of Saturn located? In 2 degrees of Capricorn. That puts it right at the point in the constellation of the Archer where the forward hand of the Archer grasps the bow. And since the bow is drawn, fully drawn, and the arrow is fully retracted to be released, you know that the head of the arrow is going to be very close to the knuckles of the forward hand that grasps the bow. And so the arrowhead and the hand grasping the bow in the graphic figure of the archer defines the location of the aphelion of Saturn, and the feet of the twins, the perihelion. Now that's quite a picture. And both the aphelion and the perihelion carry two different leitmotifs, but they are very closely related. The leitmotif associated with the aphelion of Saturn is the Arthurian warrior path, appropriately located in that place in the archer that I just described. So you see, this is a granular detail of the cosmic code beyond astronomy and astrology, both. And I think it's pretty interesting that if the perihelion of Saturn indicates the perennial and trans-historical development of the Magian order and the Gnostic movement, as Willy Sucker indicated to me many years ago in Los Angeles, well, I think it's remarkable that the opposite point represents the Arthurian warrior path, because the Arthurian warrior path was created in the 4th century, 3rd or 4th century AD, as a rear guard action to defend the diaspora of the pagan mysteries, wasn't it? You'll also find that in the alternative history of the Grail, and I don't think you'll find it anywhere else in any other book around. And you know, when I emphasize the originality of what I do, and that you only find it in Lash and nowhere else, strange as it may seem, I'm not doing that to blow my own horn. I'm doing that to underscore in your mind the realization that it's only originality that counts, and that the mark of the active, fertile, mature exercise of the luminous epinoia by a human animal is originality. You stand on the threshold with your participation in the Gaia Navigation Experiment and your observation of the sacred narrative. You stand on the threshold of a way of life that is nothing but originality. There is nothing but originality coming out of it. You have to try to wrap your mind around that. You produce original material, like I do, when you are really using the luminous epinoia. You're really demonstrating it. It demonstrates itself in originality. And so you find the originality of certain great works of art demonstrate that. Now, that capacity is inherent to every human animal, depending on your desire to own it and cultivate it. Okay? I'll say no more about that right now, because I want to be sure that I get to the point of this briefing by the time the briefing is over. So, you look up at this unique constellation of factors at the height of the proscenium arch. And you know that that represents the Gnostic moment, because the lunar apogee is in a stall at the feet of the twins. It represents a surge moment, because the sunrise crescent passes through its apogee on July 7th. It carries an additional factor, which is the presence of Jupiter, and again an additional factor, which may be considered to be a diachronic background factor, which is coincidence with the perihelion of Saturn. So the Gnostic impulse comes back to humanity in the Gnostic moment. It came back in December of 1945, when the Nag Hammadi books were discovered in a cave in southern Egypt. It came back again in 1967 with the appearance of the Nag Hammadi Library in English. It came back again in the early years of the 21st century through metahistory.org with my commentaries on the Nag Hammadi literature. And it came back again in November 2006 with the publication of Not in His Image. And now it's coming back again. Can you see the acceleration of these events? Can you see the shortening of the time? That the shortening of the time between these events is an indication of a syntropic escalation. A syntropic escalation of the luminous wisdom of the grail within human imagination. That is what you are seeing. That is what you are enacting. And that is the meaning of the factor of second attention of the goddess. Because it is she herself who carries that same impulse in her own imagination. It's like if you have a child and the child shows itself at the age of 4 or 5 to be talented in woodworking, then you as the parent carry in your imagination a visualization of the growth of that child following its own natural talents, so that it grows and becomes, say, a woodworker or a sculptor of wood. And hopefully, as a good parent, you allow the child to follow its own creative instincts, and you provide it with the circumstances for optimization of the learning process. But what you do primarily is you support the child by anticipating its maturity. And you visualize and imagine what it can do based on the talents that you see in it. Well, she sees certain talents in us, and you can be sure that she sees them to perfection because she put them there in the first place. Okay? So she sees the talent of gnosis, of ecstatic cognition, and of the whole method of the mysteries, giving intimacy with her naked, aeonic light substance. She sees all that as your talent, your internal capacity, your human potential, if you will, your potential for peak experience. And she holds that visualization right now and through the Gnostic moment while the lunar apogee is stalled at the perihelion of Saturn. So much for the second attention. Now, what about the first attention? How can I say that she's coordinating that vast moment with the first attention? Well, in order to picture what's happening with the first attention and to graphically comprehend the merge of the two, you have to imagine that the stage floor on which we're standing beneath the proscenium arch is transparent. And so the arch is actually a total circle, but we can't see most of the circle because the rim of it is below us. So we see above the stage 180 degrees of the proscenium arch. But if the stage floor is glass, we can also kind of look down and we can see the extension of the proscenium arch into the mirroring semicircle beneath our feet. You get the picture? We can't see the entire mirroring semicircle because you're standing on it and it's awkward to look behind you. We'll look down and look behind you. You can't see the part you're standing on, but you can see a certain extension on either side. Now, look over to the left. Find the place where the proscenium arch reaches the 180-degree mark. That's where it stands on the floor of the stage. But since the stage floor is glass, look below. And you look down for another 20 or 25 or 35 degrees. And what you see there, in zodiacal terms, is the vast sprawling composite of the constellation of the Virgin. So looking straight up, you see the bull on the right and the twins on the left, and looking down 90 degrees and then another 30 odd degrees, you see the constellation of the Virgin from her head, her body, her torso, and her knees because she's kneeling. And right there on her knees, is the planet Saturn. The way that you can graphically or physically, kinetically place yourself in this scenario is to look up at the proscenium, stand up, and look up vertically at the center of the proscenium arch, and then bring your right hand down to about 120 degrees. First bring your left hand. Extend your left hand to 90 degrees. That's the bottom of the arch above the stage. Then let your left hand drop so that there's a separation of your hand of about 120 degrees from where your hand is pointing to the apex of the proscenium arch. There, in 5 degrees of Scorpio, which is 123 degrees beyond 2 degrees of Cancer, a trine in water signs, if you will, in astrological terms, there, at 123 degrees separation, is the planet Saturn. And what's it doing? Well, it's doing something that it only does twice a year for about 8 or 10 days. It is reversing its motion. For 5 months now, the planet Saturn has been shifting backwards in the Virgin, shifting back against the order, natural order of the zodiac. And it has been shifting back until it reached its furthest point of retrograde, which is in 5 degrees of Scorpio, or 215 degrees on the ecliptic scale. Now, as I said, visually and graphically, you can go out and see that. You can't see the 215-degree mark on the scale, because that's an intellectual artifact. but you can see Saturn at the knee of the Virgin. And you will be able to observe over a period of time that Saturn now slowly starts to move forward, so that after a short period of time, it will again move out of the Virgin. We know what happens at that point. There is a tiny star called Kambalia, the alchemist star, that represents the extreme limit of the constellation of the Virgin. So Saturn is going to make its third transit over Kambalia, the alchemist star. And what requires your total attention at this moment right now is a granular detail of the astronomical picture. That at the very moment of the lunar surge of July 6th, with Jupiter present in the surge, giving it a tremendous amplification or magnification, because that is the characteristic of Jupiter, expansion, right? That's basic astronomy, and it is the most expansive planet. It's a gas giant. It's far bigger than any other planet. So the quality and dynamic of Jupiter is expansion, magnification of the Gnostic impulse at the very moment that Saturn is in its station, that it's standing still. It's stopped retrograding, and it hasn't yet begun to move ahead. That is the indication of what she's doing with her first attention. And so you can see why I say that there is an exact coordination on July 7th between the first attention indicated by Saturn in its retrograde, in its direct station, retrograde turning direct, and the lunar apogee, surge, Jupiter, perihelion of Saturn configuration. That is the concurrence of her first and second attention. And I'd point out something to you, just again to blow my horn, but really not for that, to make you feel how special this really is and how exciting it is to know what you know. There are many people in the astrological field who study cosmic patterns, and they interpret many things from these patterns based solely on astrology and not on real astronomy. So, for instance, if there might happen to be something like a cosmic trine in the water signs, you know, a cosmic trine in the water signs, well, there is, in fact, a cosmic trine in the water signs, come to think of it. You have Jupiter in 2 degrees of Cancer, trine Saturn in 5 degrees of Scorpio. That would mean that you need something in the early degrees of Pisces, right? Well, I wonder about that. Hold on. Well, whoopsie-daisy. I had to go look at the Swiss ephemeris on the other computer because I don't have my books with me here. But of course, Neptune is currently located in 6 degrees of the sign Pisces. So there is currently a grand trine in water signs, Neptune, Jupiter, Saturn. Now, that's the kind of thing that astrologers will make a career on. They will write endlessly about this. I'm sure that there are 2,000 astrological blogs running right now where they are interpreting, embellishing, and discussing the grand trine in water signs involving Neptune, Jupiter, and Saturn, without one single reference whatsoever to the actual astronomy. They're just looking at the tropical starless framework of conventional astrology. Now, the problem with that is twofold. One, that way of looking at the sky just gives people a license to jive and to pour out an enormous amount of interpretive bullshit. The second point, which is even more important, is it's extremely misleading to those of you who might want to delve deeply into the workings of cosmic patterns. You really want to know what cosmic patterns are. Well, it might seem that if you're an astrologer and you're standing there with your massive toolbox of astrological concepts, the signs, the aspects, the nodes, the planets, the houses, the midpoints, and all of these very complicated tools laid out on your drafting table, if you're in that position and you're beholding a grand trine in water signs, it might look like you were in a position to apply your tools to that event and to come forth with some really significant resonating revelations about what it means. But no, that doesn't happen. And the reason why it doesn't happen is because the true way to observe cosmic patterns is by their granular detail. To stand back and observe cosmic patterns is in an abstract manner, using the abstract tools and paradigms of astrology, can at best lead to a kind of, I don't know what to say, a kind of jive. And sometimes the jive is relevant, but a lot of the time the jive is just shuck and jive. And that's how astrologers make a reputation for themselves, by the skill and flair of their shuck and drive. And so astrology in that application can be extremely distracting. And I want you to focus in your minds that you have the opportunity to operate with a method that is not an astrological method. The method used in the GNE is not an astrological method. It's a method of forensic astronomy. And with the simple set of tools, very simple compared to conventional astrology, believe me, because I've used both set of tools, and I know how to use both of them extensively. But the relatively simple set of tools that you are acquiring in the GNE is basic to forensic astronomy. And the foundational rules of forensic astronomy are quite simple. One of them is to coordinate observation with designation. Okay? So when you look up at the proscenium arch and you designate the midpoint or apex of the arch as 90 degrees, that's a designation. It's 90 degrees on the ecliptic scale. It's a mental paradigm. It's a concept. But then you combine that conceptual designation with the actual observation of where that point is in the zodiac between the bull and the twins. So I'm teaching you how to do that. The second rule, and this should probably be the primary rule of forensic astronomy, is demonstrated in the whole course of this briefing, namely that to observe the working of cosmic patterns over eons of time, extending even to the cosmic design of the pleromic aeons, you need to observe it in granular detail. You will only see it in granular detail, and you can only live it in granular detail. And what I've described in this briefing is a magnificent example of granular detail. And let me assure you of something. You've probably heard the cliche that of all the moments of time, you know, in the illusion of linear time, the illusions of linear time, in all those moments, past, present, and future, every moment is unique. Is it? Well, how would you know? How would you know? Living in the blur of linear time, day to day, week to week, month to month, and then that blurred cycle is subsumed into the larger cycle year after year, you know, decades, centuries. You're caught in these rotating wheels within wheels, a kind of archontic clockwork system of the illusions of linear time. And how would you know, caught in that mechanism, that every moment is unique? or you can teach yourself to see how every moment is unique through the method that I'm using here. And when I say unique, I mean following the method of Idris. It is not only unique in its meaning and in the dimension of the story it reveals, the dimension of the myth of humanity it reveals, but it's also literally astronomically unique. You can go to, grand shrines in water signs happen quite frequently, and they happen in various combinations. But you can go to an astronomer, I swear, go to a professional astronomer who has sophisticated ephemerides and ask them to find a moment when the sunset crescent in the cycle of Idris passes its apogee, with the apogee in convergence with the perihelion of Saturn and Jupiter as well, located in that apogee, coinciding with a station of Saturn. Those are the parameters. Go give them to an astronomer and ask him or her to search for another moment when that happened. I would be very surprised if you could find one, but it would be at least 2,500 or 3,000 years ago at the very best. And you'd be lucky if you could find it. You see the overarching patterns of the cosmos, the very designs of the pleromic aeons merging into the patterns of human history in granular detail, or you don't see it at all. So with that observation, I'm going to close this talk, which I originally titled Sophia's Magnificat. However, I haven't even got to Sophia's Magnificat yet. What did I mean by that? Well, I meant that this particular event of the coordination of her first and second attentions is Sophia's Magnificat. So what I've done in this briefing is I've set up the background conditions. So I'm going to call it, the forensic astronomy. Let's say I'm going to retitle this talk Forensic Astronomy. And then installment 5 under NB73, Sophia's Magnificat. And for the sake of continuity between the two briefings, I'll give you a definition of what is a Magnificat. I had to go and look it up myself. So, of course, the first thing that comes up on Google is www.magnificat.com. Magnificat meets every need of your spiritual life, a way to more profound love of Christ. Well, isn't that special? As a church lady used to say on Saturday Night Live. Now, Magnificat, second entry, defined in Wikipedia, means in Latin, it magnifies, but they insert my soul. So the Catholic or conventional religious meaning is, my soul magnifies. Also known as the Song of Mary or the Canticle of Mary. A canticle frequently sung liturgically, blah, blah, blah. Okay, finally, here's a definition. Magnificat is, hold on, a song that celebrates or elevates the figure of Mary as the mother of Jesus. And so it belongs to the Mariological liturgy and ritual of the Catholic Church. And also, I think, of the Eastern Orthodox Church. But the Theodoxus, is that what she's called? The Theodora Theodoxus of the Eastern Orthodox Church is no better than the Virgin Mary of the Vatican, They are not Sophianic figures. Excuse me, okay? So, let's consider the options, my friend. And this is my lead-in to the fifth installment in these briefings. there is a Magnificat for the Aeon Sophia. Oh, yes, there is. Oh, yes, there most certainly is. But it's not a Magnificat that's sung from a hymn book in a cathedral by a choir of religiously zombified morons. It's a song that she herself sings. She sings her own Magnificat. And what is that? She already sung it. She already sung it once before she became the earth, when she praised the Anthropos in the presence of the demiurge Yaldabaoth. You will recall that passage from a cosmological text. What is it? On the origin of the world? When the Aeon Sophia confronted the whole horde of archons and the demiurgic overlord, Yaldabaoth, and said that at the consummation of their works, that luminous child would overcome them. That song, that anticipation of the Aeon Sophia herself, is her Magnificat. So I leave you with that thought, and I'd just like to mention in closing this briefing that I am sending to be posted three links that you can click on relative to this briefing. One of them is the link to Ernst Fuchs' portrait of Lohengrin. The other is a line of code that I use to record events in forensic astronomy. So there will be a line of code, and you will see that that code records the events of the synchronization of the first and second attention in astronomical terms. And finally, there's a link as well to Wagner's Parsifal, to the overture of Wagner's Parsifal, because I'm going to pick up the subject of Richard Wagner in the next briefing as well.